Okay, we're now starting with chapter 7. And that will agree on the process. We will do all the chapters, then we will come back to matters on which we left things rather unresolved. So we tighten them. So now at that point we wouldn't be having a debate, we would really be seeking to take it to a conclusion. Okay, chapter 7, motion. Any discussion, any point? It's a chapter about motion.
Starts from Rule 94.
No issues on motion. Honorable Matias, Honorable Waters,
Madam Speaker, our initial take on the nature of motions is that we've got two types of motions, as it were, and our view is that motions should not be alterated or mediated by administrative or bureaucratic intervention. Political parties should reserve their right to formulate motions as they choose, and motions should be circulated amongst parties for concurrence or for consensus on them, and which should be subjected to the House for such motions to be either accepted or to be rejected, and they should not be alterated by any form of intervention, and would be pleased if the motions as they are in handled and processed, perhaps that mechanism should remain without it being tampered with. Thanks.
Honorable Waters.
Thank you, Speaker. On here we clause 97.2 B. It says the number of motions without notice on the sitting day and the period of time within which such motions must be completed on that day and the sequence of party participation must be determined by the Rules Committee. I take it from this we are then going to have how we do member statements that should be in sequence. And can I ask, we currently don't have the situation, so can I ask what the motivation around that is, please? And then further down, the same clause, but D4, Roman numeral 4. And my page is the bottom of page 48. I know some people have different numberings. It says at least five parties, including the majority party and the largest minority party, must have supported the motion without notice. And I think here what we're doing is we're starting to give importance to one party over another, if we look for this, in my view. That's, the ANC and the DA currently, I mean, it's not always going to be this, but if they say a motion is okay, then it's fine. And other parties, their views are not really taken into consideration. So I'd like to get some motivation as to why at least five, where does the five come from, and what's the motivation around the governing party and the legislative opposition party as well. Thank you, Speaker.
Do you want to comment, Honourable
Orley? Thank you, Honourable Speaker. Just in terms of the proposed sequence that the Honourable Waters is referring to, sure, we don't have that at the moment. You're absolutely correct. But you will also agree with me that in terms of the scheduling of these motions in the House, there is a sequence that has been followed by the Programming Committee in determining which party's motion should be debated. Right? So this is essentially in alignment with that process. It still, of course, Honourable Speaker, doesn't prevent members from giving written notice of a motion. That can still be done. And very few parties, in fact, make use of the opportunity to give written notice of a motion. Still printed, it still appears on the order paper, and it has exactly the same status. But what we're trying to achieve is to ensure that we do not spend the amount of time that is being spent on motions, and you have all these motions appearing then on the order paper, while you know that parties only have a certain amount of motions that will be debated for that period. So that's essentially the one of alignment with what is happening there. No party will be disadvantaged because parties will still get the opportunities, and parties can still decide which motion it is that they would like to debate. I must also say, Honourable Speaker, from where we are sitting as presiding officers, when it comes to motions without notice, incredibly difficult to see whether there is a motion, for instance, in terms of the interim arrangements, indeed has been tabled at a certain time or was circulated at a specific time. And what we must keep in mind is that a motion without notice is a matter that is of national and international significance, right? And it is a view that is expressed generally by consensus by the House that we agree on this. So of course you cannot arrive in the chamber without any notice, without anyone being aware of it. You get up and you read the motion. And then you expect the House must take there and then decision. The House is comprised of different political parties with chief whips. And those chief whips should be aware before the sitting what is going to happen. And if sufficient agreement and consensus is reached. And that is the proposal that is being made, that let's align it with what is expected from the House. Not from a specific political party only, not allowing only one political party also, who has not been part of the process or discussions or whatever, just to get up and to say, no, we don't agree on it. We believe it puts unnecessary and undue pressure on the system of processing these motions and for the House to complete its business if we leave it open-ended as it is.
Honourable Waters. I hear what Honourable Potter is saying, Speaker, but I'm actually thinking about the smaller parties, actually. We haven't obviously stipulated what time period would be allowed for notice of our motion. We say that the Rules Committee must determine that. But I think what we must bear in mind is that if we only had one round, let's say we only had one round, like we currently do with member statements, certain parties wouldn't be able to read out a motion of notice on a particular sitting day. In fact, it would take several days before some of the parties. So if I may make a suggestion then, is that while we do have the sequence, but I think we should put a proviso in that at least all the parties have at least one opportunity on a particular day to give a notice of motion. I think it's important then. Okay. My second question for me is asking about the fire.
What was the second question?
The motivation around why five parties should support the motion of notice and the fact that in particular, I mean, two parties are mentioned, not by name but by position.
Mm-hmm.
No, sir, we had a long discussion about this matter. Firstly, the point that was made is that motion without notice will only qualify it if it is in line with the criteria that we have achieved. There are 8 of them. That any party present the motion without notice to the office of the Speaker, the Speaker look at it in terms of these 8 criteria. Once the Speaker says this one qualifies, and then it will be taken to the chamber, the member is notified, and then stand up in the chamber and move for a motion without notice. But the point that we try to cover is that we should avoid a situation where very important motions are presented without notice, and then one party simply rejects them. At least 5 parties, the governing party and the second largest party, plus 3 other parties, must reject the motion. Because the motion will go through the office of the Speaker, with motion without notice, there are 8 criteria. The Speaker look at them, says, oh no, this one is qualifying. This member is notified, you can read your motion. A member reads the motion in the chamber, and then parties, of course, will put a question there. Parties, then they support or not support. But the point is that we shouldn't have a situation where one party, the Volvo party, simply stand up and reject all that motion. Other parties that this would be allowed. A situation where 5 of them, they say this one is fine, we are here about it, then motion goes on. We thought that is a democratic process to do so.
Yeah, thank you, Speaker. Just on that, because our view is that, 5 parties, including the majority party and the largest minority party, and obviously 3 others, must, at 30 minutes before the sitting, inform the Speaker office that we have no objection. It should not be the other way around. Because, I mean, it's certainly quite cumbersome as far as admin is concerned, right? I mean, it is. Sometimes it's good, right? So why don't you take, from the PTEC, that everyone's supporting the motion, and then if people want to object, they must get the objection in 30 minutes before the time, at least. And then you can work it out that way, whether or not it does meet the criteria of 5 parties supporting it. That would be my suggestion. Okay?
I
can see what you are trying to resolve, but it would have a bigger.
If the principle is a democratic principle, it would change the nature of a motion without notice in the first instance. If it has to be voted for, it will change the what we use. The opportunity we take to use through motions without notice. Then it must be treated as any other matter that needs a division. Normally, and I think at the moment, the motions without notice are dealt with perfectly. And I think they achieve 2 things. I really think it's a perfect system. They achieve 2 things. We must not pass rules for the present. We must pass rules for the future as well. You, the opposition, it's inevitable. You are going to be opposition as the ANC. Uh-huh. We started already here in the Western Cape. So you can be opposition as well in Parliament. You must take history seriously. Uh-huh. So, motion without notice gives us an opportunity as well to hear diverse voices in the House. You can object, it falls off. If it does not come with a consensus, and that's the point of it, that we shouldn't hold, that it must be as much as possible a consensus-building form of decision. Otherwise, let's treat it like any other thing. Let's cancel the item of motion without notice. People must put motions, and they must initiate, we must gauge them, so that they can go through the proper process which is outlined elsewhere. But the activity of motion without notice is that it must be consensus, and the criteria is fine, as outlined it. It's perfect. But as for how it gets approved, let's remain with the current system. 30 minutes before objections, you go to the House, you read it, it's objected, we move on. There's no crisis about that thing. We are solving a problem that's not there.
Honorable Boy, Honorable Kubai, Honorable Front.
I don't think we are still by fear. There's nothing that we fear about not being in power, really in power. But the point is, how do we run a house? There was even and most important motions, ourselves in our own behavior. We tend to demean ourselves in the things that we say about the people if they are part away, and we say things that are totally different when we say objection, and at that time we take party as it is the institution. It's not helping us to build a proper image of parliament in the way we are coming across to the broad public. And if we want to enhance our image as parliament, we should do it in a more proper way and not allow people, after they have demeaned the house or they've demeaned that particular person, who can speak when he's dead or to his own legacy, and you just upset about him. This process will help all of us to be able to find each other. If we want to build a united nation, we'll be able to do that within the precincts of parliament. Parliament must come out as an institution that is more into confidence with South Africa than parliament in the way it's conducting itself at this particular moment, where we just observe for the sake of objection, for the sake of party divisions. That's a problem with South Africans. And we would think as African National Congress, where we think this motion in the mind is going to be handled, it's going to enhance the image of parliament, it's going to enhance the image of our country.
Thanks, Speaker. I think if Honourable Lord was saying that the criteria that is here is correct, so it means that we would stick to the criteria, not to have anything outside what the criteria stipulates. Therefore, there shouldn't be a problem with the process of approval, because the criteria would have been met. So we should just make sure that this is assisted, because it doesn't have to have motions that are read that do not meet the criteria in the House. And you are reading a motion knowing that it's going to be rejected. Now it's like we are in some playing ground. We just looking for fun's sake. Now, shouldn't we just do what we know is going to be right and approve what we process what we are going to agree with? Because the criteria is very clear. Actually, even at some point, we should just say anything that has been rejected outside shouldn't even arrive at the House. So once the criteria has been put, we meet the criteria. The motion that is going to be invited in the House is already agreed to, we know it's going to be agreed to. Because it doesn't help to have this. And so what Honourable Ndozi is saying that we are not so, if he hasn't been the problem currently, I'm not so sure what will happen. There is currently a problem where you have somebody who is very significant to the country, we want to send the condolence. We say, no, we agree with the condolence, but we reject the motion because it's proposed by so-and-so. It's a problem. Because you are denying Parliament an opportunity to express itself in relation to significant, important people within our society. Wishing somebody a speedy recovery because it's a person that has a significant role in our society. You want Parliament to express. For the past few months, we have not had that opportunity. National teams have not had any even a congratulatory message from Parliament, but we've been rejected. How do we significantly as Parliament form part of what happens in our society? Because I think motions have been made in such a way that we are able to form part, and we make South Africans who represent us or who play a particular critical role still feel that the House, which is of its representative, of their representatives, can actually send them a message, talk to them, communicate to them. But I think currently there is something wrong. We need to fix it. Thanks.
Honourable Crowley.
No, thank you, Honourable Speaker. Honourable Speaker, the question is, what is the intention of a motion without notice? What do we expect or ask the House to do? Essentially, we ask the House to agree. You ask the House to agree. And to reach that point, there needs to be a process of engagement beforehand. So that on such a matter, I don't even want to raise certain instances, Honourable Speaker, where on issues that were really non-controversial, where under motions without notice, political parties take opposing views. There was a former member who passed away. Their parties objected towards expressing condolence against that. Now, that is not a place for a motion without notice. Motion without notice is where parties generally agree beforehand that this will go to the House and the House has agreement on it. Every representative of the people who are out there, because it cuts across the different political divides and lines that we have. We also want to state, Honourable Speaker, that there are sufficient
space created on the parliament program and on everything then, through your motions and also through statements, where you can express this festival of ideas that political parties have. Opportunities are created. So it's not as if a certain area is now shut down. What we're saying is that that area must be regulated when it comes to motions without notice.
The problem is that I hear the only complaint, by the way, is the condolence motions. But 90% of the time, the ANC objects to the majority of the motions in the House because they say there are things that are uncomfortable to them. But motions without notice, at least people know that such a motion was pushed and the ANC objected. But it is aired to the people. And to say that, I mean, you are recruiting, it must be, so Parliament must be run by yourself and the DA only. Only the things that you and the DA agree, or that includes you and the DA, will only ever be said in the House with regards to motions without notice. That is effectively what the process is. That's undemocratic. That is not multi-party democracy. That's the tyranny of majority. Because if you read this, at least five parties, including the majority party and the largest minority party, have notified the Speaker to the National Assembly, and as soon as it is told before the sitting, that they have no objection to the motion being moved without notice. That is reactionary. This is not democracy. This is the tyranny of the majority. We need a balanced democracy. Our constitution commits us to multi-party democracy. That's the first point. I understand on condolences. Two, we have an opportunity to say things in front of the whole country, and you must reject them. You must object them so that that's the opportunity of as well of motions without notice, as far as this criterion that you've outlined is concerned. So what if the ANC objects to everything? We just end up saying condolences and congratulations only. The criteria gives us a much broader space. But every time the largest majority party objects, the motion without notice won't be read. According to this particular criteria, it can be. You can even write in the rules that you must never object to condolences. I don't mind at all. But you can't give it only to specific parties that if they object, then the motion must not come into the House. It can't be. A motion must be read and you must object so that you are known that you have objected to certain things, at least that meets this criteria. And we're solving a problem. I agree with you on everything except how it's going to be decided. This is the tyranny of the majority. That's what I'm saying. If you want it this way, let's change the whole thing of a motion without notice, because it falls apart. Let's submit substantive motions, debate, because we'll have an opportunity to object in a substantial way to the things that you are putting forward. In that way, our voices are heard. Otherwise, minority parties and all the other small parties are not going to have an opportunity to ever say things as long as the ANC does not want. You have killed the whole intention of a motion without notice.
Honorable Boy, Honorable...
You know, when you... I thought that the process is simple. This is the subcommittee's views presented to the Rules Committee. And that is always good with any human being. Raise what is it that you are saying could assist in resolving a problem without providing labeling. But labeling is not assisting you, and you're not making sense in a particular way. But what is important is that at least five parties, if you object, give an alternative that how do we make it democratic in your own sense, rather than start labeling as those. When you degenerate into that, it's not helping the Rules Committee to move forward. And the ANC never said anything. It does, these are options. And options that have been discussed within the subcommittee. So all of us were participants. If you have not heard the government, then this is an opportunity to go through it and make a suggestion. And that's the opportunity that was provided. And not a ban, but I mean the labeling is not assisting us. No, I'm just saying. I'm just saying that this is what is in front of us.
The largest majority and the thing at the moment is you and the DA. How am I supposed to see when you make a rule like this?
Order, honourable members. Honourable, if you are through, I want to pass on to Honourable Didiza. After Honourable Didiza, Mr. Handig. After Mr. Handig, it's Honourable Matias, then Honourable Dagane.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I thought in terms of the issues that were discussed regarding the motions about notice, because there are two. With respect to motions, I think parties could still express their views, raise issues that they want to raise. But the reason, maybe the core reason for the motion without notice was really to afford Parliament an opportunity to express a collective view to the various constituency about what Parliament feels. It could be a condolence, it could be a congratulation, it could be nothing, you know, a significant occurrence in our society, like where you might have an outstanding scientist to have come with an innovation of sorts that will take our country forward, globally competitive, or it could be nothing, a significant event which is of international importance, where as a country part of the global community, we are concerned about the latest event in Nigeria, you know, the bombings and Syria, what's happening there. So these are issues where Parliament as an institution may want to express itself. That was my understanding, and if I'm wrong, Speaker, of what the motions without notice were about. But we're not about expressing a political view on a matter where you may want to engage in debate, and that space is there. And what I thought the reason for expanding, you know, the number of people who can express an opinion as a representative body in Parliament was to ensure that it's not just one party that objects, and therefore when more parties feel that this matter does need, you know, that stage where Parliament expresses itself, their voices then are not heard. I appreciate that the EFF may be concerned about why should you give a particular emphasis on two parties. Maybe that's the issue of debate. But the issue of actually allowing more voices to express their support to a motion so that it does carry, I don't think it's the route to go, Honourable Speaker. And I would persuade our colleagues to consider that.
Thank you, Speaker. I just wanted to emphasize one point, and that is that the objections that sub 4 refers to are objections to the without notice. So it's where there's objections to a proposal because of the content of the proposal. If it is political, parties want to think about it, want to research, want to consult, want to have time to prepare for a discussion and for a decision. So the objection is simply on technical grounds to the taking a decision, to being asked to take a decision without any prior notice. That's all it's about. It's not about objecting to the substance of the contents of the motion.
Madam Speaker, Honourable Ndlozi has made a very profound point when he says, whatever that we do and what this process seeks to achieve should not compromise posterity. The rules that we make here must envisage a future where the future is not compromised at expense and at altar of political expedience. Now, that's very profound. And this resolve by the ANC confirms what one leader of the ANC at one point says, there's no any other danger to the ANC except the ANC itself. No force whatsoever poses danger to the ANC except the ANC. And this has been a revealed here, that you are a danger to yourselves in a manner in which you want to short-circuit the process of democratic participation, the process of multi-party democracy, and you would be really, really worried. This is a worst form of degeneration
of a formal liberation movement.
The worst form of degeneration.
Now, before I did not choose of being part of the liberal anti-majoritarian offensive, we're making a profound argument here that that which is the standard yourself, which is your degeneration today, amounts to what Honorable Joseph calls the tyranny of the majority. And you are beyond that history will come and judge you and will judge you harshly. Now, the point I'm making is the current criteria, the current system through which motion without notices are being processed is the best system. It ought to be kept. It should not be tampered with. And the criteria has been outlined here. These are safety mechanisms to ensure that motions are in keeping with the 9 criteria that criteria areas which are contained in the rules. So our advice is that be aware of that this is the worst form of degeneration, and we call upon you, use your wisdom to save Parliament from sinking in further state of abyss.
No, Madam Speaker, I
think that. I may ask something so that if Honorable Ndakane will deal with it as well, unless you don't want to. Because. Yeah, can you explain number Roman figure 4? It says there will not contain statement conditions, arguments, or other matters not strictly necessary to make the proposed resolution intelligible. Can you give an example of something like this, Honorable Ndaga? Thank you.
Madam Chair, was not really on for the Honorable Ndaga's right assertion that the criteria they sent makes sense. They accept them. The point that I was just raising to look at it is that they have been objecting some of this issue for some time. There is no likelihood that we are going to agree with them on this matter. Because in principle they have rejected it for some years now in terms of the subcommittee. But the point that I wanted us to raise on Madam Chief is that there is no way where any party is excluded. Because if you read it correctly, Honorable Member, it says that at least five parties would include the governing party and the second largest party. And there's no way that it says EFF is as true that. Because any of the three parties, including the two, can object on the 10 cuts out for a motion to be presented in the chamber. And then we explain also, Honorable Speaker, that firstly the motion will go to the office of the Speaker, because we use the secretary. The secretary, but it does that on behalf of the Speaker. Look at the criteria. If the criteria are fine, the motion then is allowed to be read by a member in the chamber. And then once the member has read the motion without notice in the chamber because it qualifies in terms of the criteria, then a question is put. Once a question is put there, then the parties of course this will try to secure that we don't reject everything because we want to reject it, even when it makes sense to many parties on that. I'm not sure how is undemocratic really to do so, because I think we are covering EFF itself. It can be part of the 5, and then any other party can be part of the 5 and take a decision on this matter. In our view, Honorable Speaker, since from the subcommittee, was that we have not heard the objection of the EFF, but we took a wrong view that we should continue the way it is, must present it to the Rules Committee and persuade the Rules Committee to agree with the manner in which we have phrased it. We think it's correct. It doesn't discriminate against any party.
It's on sub 4, which Mr. Ndlozi refers to. The purpose of that, and that applies not just to motions without notes, but to all motions, is that the motion itself should not become a speech or debate and should not contain the motivation. The motion is simply the decision the House is being asked to take. The motivation is presented in debate before leading up to that decision being taken. So the motion, the decision of the House, and this is a question of putting correct weight on the importance of decision of the National Assembly of the Parliament of South Africa, needs to be concise and needs to be clear and needs to be worded almost like the wording of a bill. It needs to be very precise, because the decision you're going to communicate our Parliament for others to respond to. That's the thinking behind that.
Okay. I think we've had adequate opportunity to air various views and approaches on this particular matter. Is there any other matter in this chapter that anyone would like to raise? I think when this was just remembered on page 51, sort of in the middle, the withdrawal or lacking of motions. I think we must discuss the one option that was put on the table, which was to consider providing that if the member in charge wishes to alter the wording of his or her motion at the time when formally moving the House, he or she may do so with the leave of the House with unanimous concurrence if the proposed alteration is not substantive. I think we must just see which one of those, which one we're going to go with, which one will be the easiest. Are there any views on that matter? Sure, I can say that the option we're given to sort of give the person proposing the motion a little bit more scope in case something had changed. Because you know what happens is sometimes you come to the House and you may have got a date wrong or a time wrong or something like that. I mean, it's not substantive in its nature, but it just offers you the opportunity to correct the mistake that may have been made. Especially it happens, as you know, sometimes does when motions are coming through quite rapidly and things are being processed very fast.
Is there any objection to that? That should be a problem.
Yes,
Perhaps could be a unanimous concurrence on that issue. Because it means if there's no unanimous concurrence, then the change can be effected. So maybe members need to comment on that.
Are we not complicating matters here? Well, surely a motion can be amended at any time in the House. And that's generally done by a majority vote in the House. If you give a motion in the House, I can move an amendment, the mover can move an amendment to ANC, you know.
All right, anything else in this chapter? This is very progressive. We're moving to chapter 8.
To raise one issue. It's a matter that is still outstanding on our state. We are working on it. The matter that you refer to the subcommittee in terms of section 89 of the Constitution. We are still working on that one. The proposal that we are putting forward, I think towards the end, I think we have separated it already. I think we should look at that because it's part of the regimes of motion.
It's not a substantive matter, but something we're going to have to tidy up when we do the fund process. We refer different parts to a private member and others member. I think a member is sufficient. I think the only objection needs to do with private members is when we deal with private members, registered proposals. But look at 1031. This is a private member. And we just need to decide which one we want and then clean it up throughout.
Madam Speaker, let me clarify. I think the intention here is to draw a distinction between members of the executive and members of parliament, one of the executive. because this request can only be made by members who are not in the executive. Request for step debates.
Okay.
Yes.
Marble Zovich?
No, I thought the Honorable Steenhaven is proposing that we must never use the word private in relation to members of parliament. I mean, members of parliament are hardly private. Everything about us is out there. So maybe we can find the wording, and I think the secretary has a proper in the explanation now. Members other than non-executive members, yes.
Private member was always also discussed. It is defined in the definitions rule as any member other than a minister, deputy minister, the speaker, and deputy speaker. So it goes beyond just the executive. So this is really meant for ordinary members as opposed to executive members or members with an office bearer's appointment.
Madam Speaker, the point that we're trying to raise was trying to be in line with what is called private members here. That's what we are trying to cover here. That just distinguishing between the executive, the speaker, the deputy speaker, and members ourselves. But I think if there's a better wording, I think we can really not mind for whoever is the worst need to put it together. As long as it makes sense the way we're trying to make sense on it. But that was the only issue there that we put it forward, not merely that all the subcommittee on that issue.
So, in fact, is there an objection to the wording private member? No objection.
So, let's pass on. It's a non-issue. Any other issue on Chapter 8? Chapter 8 is done. Chapter 9.
Honorable Waters. Thank you, Speaker. Clause, we read Chapter 9. Clause 5, where we're increasing the time for response for ministers and deputy ministers from 2 to 3 minutes. We don't support that. If you look at the current system, most ministers, in fact, all ministers and deputy ministers, except for one deputy minister, that's the deputy minister of basic education, is very enthusiastic. But generally, they do adhere and they do reply within a 2 minute period. It's very unusual for one of the presiding officers to stop a deputy minister or a minister. And I think, you know, what we try to do is members have 90 seconds in which to read out the member statements. And ministers have 2 minutes to reply, and it's short and sharp, and it keeps everything going. There's a momentum, and I think by extending it to 2 minutes, there's no need for it, and I think it's going to just bump Parliament down unnecessarily. So I'd like to hear the motivation why we think ministers should get 2 minutes, while members get 90 seconds. So, there is an option. So we're paying the old rule, or the current rule, and member statement may not be responded to more than once as well. And because we're allowing also ministers and deputy ministers to more than one minister to actually respond to a particular member statement, which could place the member under, well, we don't want to use the word attack, but, you know, yeah, attack from the executive. And I think, you know, we should limit the replies to 2 minutes and only to one particular statement. Once the minister has dealt with the statement, it's dealt with. You can't have, you know, 3 or 4 ministers going after the same member for 3 minutes each. It becomes abusive. Thank you.
Honorable Kubai.
Thanks, Peter. Just listening to what Honorable Waters is saying. One, I think most of the time they are pressed in terms of time to respond, and it has been them who complains that my response was not coming through, because you find that when the minister responds, they are able to respond to certain issues and they are not responding to others. So there are times when you find certain statements that are not responded to on our waters. And I think this is trying to close that gap because it doesn't help for a member to read a statement and then somebody does not even make a comment on it. And then the other issue which I think we need to look at, while I hear what you are saying, in terms of maybe it can open up for abuse, let's use that word, but there are times where one statement reflects onto departments. Now, when a minister stands, would respond for in on that statement a particular area, and then the other area of the report is what or the statement is not responded to. Let me make an example. If we talk about school connectivity, it affects two ministers. The Minister of Basic Education, but Minister of Telecommunications and Postal Services. Now, you might find both ministers would want to respond to that state. Now, when you put it as such a rule, now you are barring them completely to responding, which could limit even the issues how they argue. So I don't think we should really limit them.
Honorable Frolic?
No, Speaker, just on a practical point of view, and that is part of the motivation for the time of the decree. Political parties do not share with anyone which statement they're going to read on a particular day. So you sit there and there's a particular minister, all of a sudden we have to respond to five statements that happened a week or two ago. This minister has 2 minutes to respond to all of them. The question is, why do we have member statements? We have member statements so that members can raise issues, either from their constituency or of a political nature that a particular minister, an area that he or she is responsible for. Of course, there's an expectation then from members as well to get a response from the relevant member of the executive if he or she is in the House. However, what happens is that very often it happens now that due to a 2-minute limitation, ministers can only respond to one, at most 2 issues that were raised on a particular day. And that also deprives the member who raised the statement from a response from the member of the executive. That is why it is called ministerial responses. And I think it's a fair request that the time allocation be reduced to be increased to 3 minutes to allow for ministers to respond to those type of issues.
Thanks, Speaker. Speaker, we discussed such a link in the subcommittee. And I think that the problem that's arisen in Parliament is that the minister replies to all statements in one go. And the feeling was, if I and Honourable Lotrick and Honourable Lorimer ask Minister Gigaba, we each one of us have a statement that relates to Home Affairs, the Minister Gigaba must stand up and say, on my first ministerial response, I will respond to Honourable Lorimer. And he responds to Honourable Lorimer within the 2-minute period. Then he says, in my second, because there was another statement to me, Honourable Lotrick, and responds to Honourable Lotrick for a period of 2 minutes. And then says, then there was also a statement made by Honourable Mazzoni, and I'm going to respond to her statement now, and then respond to it. Because what's happening at the moment is the ministers cluster every statement that comes in, and that's why we find that people aren't getting a response. So what's going to have to happen is the ministers are actually going to have to take notes of who has asked, who has made what statement regarding their portfolio, and then when they stand up, they must indicate to which member of parliament they are responding in their statement. And that particular response must then be the 2-minute response. But that means that a minister could possibly reply to 3 different members, and then have 6 minutes, in fact, because each statement is being responded to. And I think that will alleviate a lot of the frustration that we have in the House, the members feeling that they're not responded to, and then the ministers also aren't under that pressure to fall within the time period to try and answer everyone in one go. Chair, and in terms of what Honourable Gabbard is now about the different ministers being responsible to answer the question, I understand that, I know that practically it's happened, but it does happen quite rarely. And I don't think that the House or, in actual fact, anyone would object if another minister stood up and said, the statement actually related to a portion of my portfolio, and I would like to answer that particular section of my portfolio. But they let the House, they inform the House that they are answering to that particular section which they feel relates to their portfolio.
That makes sense. Honourable Njovi and Honourable Mdagani.
Yeah, thanks. I think that we'll agree if equally the time of statement is increased. There's no
no problem. And you know what's depressing to me, and I think we must think about this, is Parliament being dominated by one voice.
Yeah.
You increase the time of ministers, you increase the time of president, you increase, we must give more voice to the rest of everyone else. So if you increase the time of responses, increase the time a statement takes as well, or amenable, people can respond. Most of the statements, at times, ministers choose sometimes not to respond. In fact, most of the cases, even when they stand, they are not giving precise answers. It's also a political response. So it provides for a dynamism that, at least from the point of view of the EFF, we think it's important to Parliament. But if, as long as the principle is you give them more time, you equally give members more time. Because we have an opportunity to make one statement a day when statements are made. Other smaller parties as well. And I keep saying smaller parties, none of them are here. So I'm sure that they appreciate, if we increase the number of ministers, the time for ministerial responses, let's move our time as well. 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
No, sir. Madam Speaker, I think Honorable Natasha has covered a point that we're worried about. That is very important for ministers to indicate this question they are answering or statement that answering. And then we thought that the timing is really, we're not necessarily married to it, but our understanding of the politics of it is that a member of parliament stands up, a member of National Assembly stands up there to read the statement. The main purpose is to get answer from the minister in order for the member to go and answer his or her constituencies. That was our broad understanding, that no member in the chamber stood up there just to read a statement for the sake of reading the statement. They read the statement precisely because they want answers. These answers then assist members of parliament to communicate and then convey the message to their constituencies. 3 minutes or 2 minutes, we're looking at the issue. That sometimes ministers, they want to give detailed answers because the member is serious about the answer because they want to address his or her constituency. We thought that really doesn't cause harm for members of parliament. And of course, we didn't look at what the Honorable Doses say. But our view was that a member's statement should be very brief because the member wants an answer. That answer is very useful for the member to go and report to the constituency. We thought 3 minutes is sufficient, Honorable Speaker.
I think Honorable Members, Honorable Mazzoni's approach is the one that helps every issue that has been raised in this regard. I don't think it should still preoccupy us to extend the time for responses. I think the 2 minutes to deal with each issue that has been raised by a member of parliament should cover us. Then we move to chapter 10. We're making progress. Honorable Pioneer, is in chapter 9 still?
Yes, sorry, it's just the last one around members, around executive statements. 106. See now that we're giving cabinet members a chance to do a sweep afterwards. I still like to know what the reason of that for that is and why it's so long. We're really giving them 20 minutes to make the executive statement. Now, I mean, there should be matters where they come and brief the House. Parties have been given 3 minutes of their current rule to respond. I think that the minister wants to respond at the end, it should come out of that global 20 minutes. I don't think we should give him the executive 25 minutes to speak, and we are only given 3 minutes. It's completely imbalanced and disproportionate. But no problem with the 20 minutes, no problem with the current production of 3 minutes, but I've got a problem with extending it with a sweep at the end. I think the minister wants to come at the end. It must come out of the global 20 minutes.
Well, in terms of minutes, we are not married to them, but the point that we are raising is that there are 13 parties in parliament. Then all of them make their contribution on a statement made by the minister. The minister can't cover all 13 parties within 2 minutes. It's just not impossible. The reason why they don't also come every hour and make statement in the chamber. It happens once in 6 months or once in 3 months. Because that really 5 minutes would be sufficient. We can also take the point that Honorable Stenhisen is raising that should be within the 20 million that is given to the minister. We are happy with that. We don't think there is a big issue. In terms of time, in terms of 3 or 2 minutes, was really a discussion that we might also allow ministers to give answers and have time to do so. But we are not having a problem on this issue.
Just on this, if I may respond why I don't think it's not a debate. I mean, these are factual policy statements that they're making, so it's not a debate that's being entered into. So it's not like they've got to come back into sweep where there's a debate. But they shouldn't be bringing, you know, controversial matters. They should be a briefing to Parliament on something that has happened. And that's why the time limited for parties, we've limited the time, is because we want to actually encourage it. And that it's wrong that we only have executive statements every 6 months. Members, ministers should be free to come to the House and brief the House on significant matters. And I've always been concerned that if we can add, and that's why we agreed to 2 minutes per party, not having a proportional time per party, because it keeps it short and sharp, and ministers will not shy away from coming and briefing us on important matters in the department. But I think the 20 minutes is fine. They can structure, you know, 10 up front and 10 at the bottom if they want to.
Okay. Can we then go to the chapter on questions?
Chairperson's going to roll his eyes now. Madam Speaker, I mean, one of the things that we need to create is a vibrant part parliament, and one of the features around the world is parliaments have an opportunity from time to time to have unscripted questions, where there's actually an exchange between ministers and the president. And so we want to do, and we argued in the subcommittee, and that there is an opportunity for us to have questions without notice. Much like you have Prime Minister questions in House of Commons and various others, where there's an unscripted exchange between the two. I think it doesn't help us when ministers come to the House with questions and just read out a pre-prepared script that's been prepared by somebody in the department. And I think it would be a lot more lively exchange if we created some mechanism where not every question there, but from time to time there are opportunities for members to engage with ministers in an unscripted way. And Honourable Kabayi, we're very happy to know that we have put our money where our mouth is, and this is done in the Western Cape Provincial Legislature. The Premier takes questions without notice at least once a month from members of this head.
Just on the issue, the unscripted questions, if you look at Clause 108.6, which is questions for oral reply to ministers, we have to give 6 working days for them. And when it comes to the president, which is Clause 111.3, it's going to be 16 calendar days. Now, often issues arise from between when you submit oral questions to the oral question day that are of national importance that you would like to, or that are important that the minister should be answering in the House, right? And this would allow that kind of flexibility. So if, for example, the Minister of Health was supposed to be answering questions and you submit your oral question, but something happened at a particular hospital that you feel that he needs to answer to, you'd be able then to raise a particular issue in Parliament. And I think it holds the executive to account. Now, I do believe we need to have some form of system where we are allowed a certain time, maybe, or whatever, to have unscripted questions for ministers, the deputy president, and the president. And then also, if I may raise the issue of in Clause 113, subsection 3, where the replies to questions are now being extended from 3 to 4 minutes for the executive. I see that we are extending the overall time from 2 to 3 hours, which I think is fantastic. It's really good. But I do feel
Speaker, if a minister can't reply within 3 minutes to a question, I mean, you know, we're going to start waffling on, and we do see that. And I say it with all due respect. I'm not saying every minister does it. But, you know, we want ministers to be short and sharp with their replies. Obviously, the one to proper reply, but I don't see why 4 minutes is necessary. And again, we're just extending the time of the executive in the House. And I think keeping 3 minutes is ample time for a minister to reply to a particular question. And bearing in mind there are supplementary questions, and the minister has a further opportunity to reply to those as well. Thank you.
No, on the question, I will speak on the and it's good that to reply and engagement. We had a long discussion on this matter. And we were taking a view that the matter can be referred to the Rules Committee for decision-making purposes. But we thought that we may not be ready, but it would not harm for the Rules Committee to look at it and then pass it and then at a certain point, when the Rules Committee is comfortable with it, that it for. Or in the rules for Peru and also for decision. We listened attentively to the issue that was raised and we thought the correct one when you look to London, bearing in mind that London there are almost 800 seats to their parliament and then they will change from time to time. We thought that is a good idea in principle. But they've taken a view that maybe we should not really be putting this rule right now. It should be left to the leadership of the institution. Look at it, and over time, and they may decide to reintroduce it and have a discussion on it. But in principle, we didn't object to the view that it applies. We think that ministers are very capable of engaging any member without committing anything. And then you can't say that the ministers are weak. Ministers are very capable of doing that. But we thought that's time, another issue, to allow ourselves more time. Particularly for the leadership of the institution to look at the matter, expedite it. And then forget the view and come back to those committees for this issue.
Not yet the master of the political committee, but the political committee.
Honorable Water, Honorable
Dose. Thank you, Speaker. Speaker, I thought you were the leadership of the institution. Continue.
I say with you, but.
And secondly, Speaker, We are looking at the review of the rules. In fact, there's a comprehensive review of the rules in front of us, which we are debating. And this is an opportune time to insert such a rule in the rules, to have unscripted questions to ministers, deputy presidents, and presidents. This is the opportune time to do it. There's no need to think about it.
In other words, we need more time to internalize it and to speculate it and to finally feel okay about it. Honorable Jody, that's the reality of how the human being works.
Thank you, Peter. No, it's actually a very good idea. I agree with the direction that you are taking, Peter. But it would help if it actually put down. I don't know if the sub-rules committee, I never saw a document on it, so that we see how it would be integrated. And they say we must increase the time that the president can appear a year. Mm-hmm. Those technicalities, let's mm-hmm. just get that, because we might start being resistant if we are using the time the president can come to and turning the hour into an encrypted session. Can we just get the proposal in writing properly? Otherwise, it must happen. It must arrive.
I think that we discussed last night on the motion for the motion. Yeah, I'm not going to the other parties came in, which was the closest to our position, and so they isolated me.
Questions? Can we move to messages?
Honorable
Corno?
No, before we move.
Chairperson, can I suggest questions to the Deputy President and questions to the President? I'm referring to Rule 110 and Rule 111. in rule 111-4A and 111-5A that we just improve the wording, the total time allowed to both the President and the Deputy President, that instead of saying this rule is limited to 3 hours, that we say this rule, under this rule, is limited and must not exceed 3 hours. Based on the experiences that we have recently, yesterday with the 6 questions that took 2 hours, and in the NCOP on a number of occasions 6 questions being posed, that we improve the wording to say it must not exceed 3 hours. And secondly, that there is no need for an extension by the presiding officers of the rule that stands at. The alternative may be to say be a maximum of 3 hours. Thank you.
Okay. I think that I think we need to be careful here because the President doesn't appear before us very often. And so, you know, I'm worried about the cut-off time because what you could have potentially then end up as members of the executive. I'm not saying, you know, that's what happens now, and so we're not making rules for now, we're making them for the future. You could end up with the president or deputy president who does the filibuster because question 6 on the order paper is not to their liking. They just filibuster the responses until 3 hours is up to avoid the question. I like the current situation where 6 questions that we... And if we sit until those six questions are completed, you could well end up with somebody who doesn't like question 5 or question 6 and ensure that we don't get to it. So I like with the President particularly. The Deputy President with us more regularly, so I'm not that fussed about it. But certainly with President, we mustn't give anybody the opportunity to leave after our answering those 6 questions. Because they are limited and we only see them once a quarter.
I'm not getting involved in this matter, Nina.
No, let me just see whether there's anything about this matter. Honorable Deputy Chief Whip, Honorable Mutakane.
Thanks, Honorable Speaker. I think the maximum of 3 hours is okay, because right now the President is responding to 6 questions, of which he finishes within 2 or 2.5 hours. So the maximum is okay. I agree with Comrade Gore now.
Chair, with the wording of it, really, we don't have a problem. I think we can word it the way we want to be very precise and very succinct. But the point that the Honourable Warren Office raised is to delete then which may be extended by presiding officer. Our view initially was that presiding officers must allow some authority or some power to see debates and then decide whether they extend by 1 minute or 2 minutes. Once you take a cut and dry approach, it's very difficult for presiders to manage it. Because they will have to, don't forget that the head of state, when he addresses the house, the time is unlimited. He can address up for 5 days, but the time is unlimited. But here we are trying to limit it for 3 hours. But there will be a situation where maybe the presiding officer wanted to increase 1 minute or 4 minutes more. Otherwise they may be forced to say, thank you, Honorable President, your time has expired. Sometimes it's not a very good way of ending the head of state when it's busy answering questions. But we take a view that is the first Honorable Ureno. Maybe we can delete it, Honorable Speaker. We don't have a problem. But at the time when we're discussing in the subcommittee, we thought that the general, many all over the world anyway, many presidents don't have even time limits. The question they take hours answering your question until I exhausted as a member. Because they don't want to be accused that they are running away from Parliament to answer questions. But on this one, Honorable, we are not married to what we have drafted here. We can consider what Honorable Urenov is saying. We don't think we can really be married to it. Our view is that we should open to it, Honorable Speaker. But we wanted also President of the rest some way of managing. That was the only reason that we wanted to do it.
As far as presiding officers are concerned, there's no problem really. The formulation must be a formulation that's tidy, that's clear,
and that addresses the issue. So can it be final, like Mr. Handy, to have an input to this matter, or can you just tighten it up in the final formulation? Honorable Zozi, you have something else?
Yes, I don't know how we'll resolve this matter, but there's in the experience thus far, it's a very short experience. So I'm open to convention. But at the moment, questions to ministers. Deputy ministers can send in on behalf of the ministers. And then the experience thus far is that sometimes they give an answer that they don't know, but they literally say, I don't know, because we are asking them a question about the portfolio, but which may be relating to some executive decisions. And the proposal we have been making is that in certain instances, that follow-up question must not just fall off like that, because there would have been an admission on the part of the deputy minister that they don't know. There must be a way of either a commitment in the rule that it must be responded to either written reply or in the next session. Maybe the sub-rule committee thought about it properly than us, but that is a serious problem. When a minister is not there, the deputy minister does not respond. There's happened on two occasions where he says, I don't know.
Okay, I think we can note that particular issue and see whether there can be a way of addressing. Honourable Stienison and Honourable Mutalani.
Just another point to make. You know, the deputy president, the president, are time bound when they're supposed to be in the house. So we have a rule to hold them accountable to. But there's nothing, and I raised this in the subcom at the time. There's nothing that compels ministers to be in the house to answer their questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it over and over again. Some ministers now have missed two of the rotations in a row. And there's no recourse in the house to, you know, say to them, you know, this is not acceptable, you're not here. And I wondered if this is a place or there's another avenue we could look at. But there has to be some way of the house expressing itself, expressing its pleasure that a minister doesn't come, because you know the minister just doesn't come the whole year. The rotations and the clusters are so thick that, you know, a minister could, by missing three question sessions, avoid having to come for the whole year. And, you know, with respect, and I know many of the deputy ministers are very, very good, but they're not members of the executive. And it's our job to hold the members of the executive accountable. And if a minister just avoids coming to the house, you miss that opportunity to do so. I don't know where we deal with it, but there has to be some mechanism for Parliament to express itself on that.
Honourable Madam Speaker, my view on this one is this. Let us again put it and rework and look at it, Honourable Speaker. Was a matter that was raised, but the point out to us that now we are not prepared for anyone in Parliament. And then we assume that members of Parliament, when they're available, they're not overseas, they will attend the session and a discussion, answer questions. But we also understood that some ministers are deployed, sometimes are overseas, representing the country, unable to attend. That's why we have injected in that a deputy minister can answer those questions. At the moment, there was no rule that was saying that. We are supposing that rule because we want to address exactly what Honourable Speaker has demonstrated. But when I raised my hand, Honourable Speaker, I wanted to that for the sake of the Rules Committee to have a common understanding when we said the Deputy President will answer questions once a month during the session time. That's important, that is understanding, that we don't end up with a situation where we are told in the media that the Deputy President is running away from this. Because you should understand that is within the session, during the session only. When in January and February there are no sessions, then we can't expect the deputy president to come in and answer questions. But that's the point from the speaker. I think the rule committee must have a common understanding to avoid again sometimes a mistake in the media. People say something like we have agreed on their rules.
I'm welcoming that we can postpone how we integrate it, but perhaps much more concretely,
we must insert a rule about the attendance of ministers, that they are not allowed to meet a specific number of sessions. We could say they are not allowed because the response, even in the last Chief Priest Forum, when they are not, when the meet, like we had a current situation of the Minister of Basic Education, and she had been missing sessions. I think it was the third one. We're getting an apology, and she's going to miss it. And there was consensus from all of us that it's not about DA or the EFF. Parliament must be seen by executive members as an important aspect of their schedule, which communicates decisions way before about them appearing in Parliament. And if we can say they're not allowed to meet more than one session in terms of questions and answers, they're not allowed, so that you can't say international business is more important than coming account to the constituency. But so we don't want to do that. We don't want to end up equating Parliament in that sense. So our concrete proposal, they are not allowed to miss more than one session of the question and answer session. Thank you.
Mr. Anders?
To draw the attention to Rule 107, capital B, on page 59. That does provide for a monitoring system, and that would pick up on, obviously, the minister is not present. The question going to be answered, there will be marked as being unanswered, and therefore that system will kick in to engage with the absences of ministers and to put pressure on that minister to attend.
You just make the that's fine, but you know there's no, the House is still expressing itself, but that's the moment. If the minister doesn't come to the House, I can't write an appointed order and say, you know, there's no rule that says minister should be in attendance. And you know, really, I think that with the way the clusters are structured and the size of them, we determine the parliamentary program way in advance. It's often at the beginning of the year the parliamentary program is set up. Those dates, and to my mind, to fulfill their constitutional obligations, should be concrete in the minister's diary, and that it should only be a massively important reason why, or a personal tragedy or something that would mean that they're not coming here. I mean, really, they're so seldom here, as it is at the size of the cluster, that the minister, it has profound impacts on our ability to hold an account.
Honourable Kubai, Honourable Khadelis.
Thanks, Speaker. I think, as would I like to take some history in terms of our precedence of what has been happening, as to assist us in some of these proposals that are coming through. I would object to what Honourable Ndlozi is proposing, where we put prescriptive time. And I know that we've got to be able to acknowledge part of responsibility. You know, there are sectors that, for them to operate in the country as well, they are controlled, or the basis of the decisions at an international platform guides what happens, including what he was talking about. And OECD, that Minister Benjamin attended, is one of the global platforms that is very critical for a minister to be there. Because part of our work, we operate in a global context. Again, you'd go to issues of telecoms, which I think I'm familiar with, Honourable Ndlozi. You'd know that, for example, for a particular decision to be taken, it's taken at that platform. So as a country, you've got to be present to be able to put, I mean, issues of duty, how they came with the deadline. It was at an international platform. Now, we shouldn't try and reduce the importance of international platforms and say minister cannot, because there are certain areas where it's very prescriptive that a minister must go and that he can't get it today. Now, if you say a minister can't meet one session, if our session of questions, for example, you get a minister, there's been incidents where other ministers come to Parliament when it's question time, there are questions that we never reach them. So they're sitting there the whole time and they go. So we've got to try and balance, and I think the rules are trying to assist us, that we, as well from our side as Parliament, make sure that when we schedule question time, it's as fruitful for us and as well as for ministers. Now, the prescription, I don't think, is assisting us. Mm. We shouldn't go the route of prescribing that they shouldn't miss. And I think the current mechanism where the speaker writes to the leader of government business to say, there's been the following question, therefore, and every time the intervention that has been done by LOGP has been, I think I'm speaking from experience, having been a parliamentary councillor to the LOGP head, is that you find those interventions assisting, because the speaker will write to the LOGP, to the deputy president, and say, the following ministers have been misused. Once that is done, you see the improvement. So I don't think the current scheme has not been working. It has been working, it improves when we see things. Now, so I don't think that the issue of prescription speaker should come into the rules, not at all. I don't think the system that we have is not working.
Thank you, Speaker. I'd like to concur with Honorable Kubai on the issue of being prescriptive to the attempt of the ministers. I make just one example. The Minister of International Relations, the nature of her work, it is to be abroad to deal with these issues there. And the days for those meetings are not determined by her. So we cannot say that she must, by hook or crook, must be in the house. But what is critical is that the deputy must come and answer in the house if the minister is not in. If she is not in, that question also must be written in the, like a written response type of question. But we cannot expect that because we will not be able to fulfill that petition.
Can we now go to messages? Can we move to committee system?
Two things, Madam Speaker. The first one is the list of committees. I can't find the little section of the Constitution, but there is a we're obliged to have a committee that reviews the Constitution, one per annum. I don't know where it's here. Yeah, but you know we should list it here, the list of committees, because go back and and a joint committee. Okay, cool. Okay, great. And then just I just want to make a comment about 134 because it really is on page 70. 133, sorry, quorum requirements. Yeah. I know we all have a chuckle about it, but it really does become a problem. There's no problem with the co-option of members when we're doing minutes and we're doing committee reports, etc. But it really does become a problem when we have to co-opt members to vote on legislation, because we saw what happened just last week with the last Sunday Promotion and Protection Investment Bill was deliberated by committee. And there were members that were just brought in from the corridors to make the quorum, who'd never read the bill. And we're voting on a clause-by-clause basis. And I just don't think that it sets a very clear example for us. So I wondered if we were dealt with legislation, that there was some sort of requirement that members actually have to be seen to the committee. I know it's a difficult problem, and I know it's made difficult because of the nature of our work that we now, but I really don't think we are doing our job properly if we're just pulling people who've never ever sat in a committee to deliberate on something like legislation. And I don't know how we deal with it. I don't have a solution. But really, it's not a good reflection on it.
Honorable Didiza.
Thank you, Honorable Speaker. I think that matter, maybe the subcommittee may reflect on it. However, we need to be conscious that the reality of our situation at the moment is that you do have smaller parties. Because of the size of their numbers, they may not be in every committee. And therefore, depending on the issues, they may prioritize at the other two submissions, as they've done some of them, and where maybe voting in a particular committee has to happen, they will then participate. They may not have been there every time. So I'm just saying that, unfortunately, it's an issue we have to live with. You've got PAC, that's called one. So even if they may want with all the will in the world, they can never be in all the committees of parliament. But they may have an interest on that committee that's on the voting that they may want to participate. So I'm just saying that as we reflect on this, we need to be conscious of that reality. Thank you.
For clarity, the Rule 134 on co-option at the moment, the proposed legislation would be removed.
but not be retained. There's only an option there to be in back. The proposal from the subcommittee is to remove the co-option clause.
Honourable Deputy Chief Whip.
No. Umkhavile usithola. Umkhavile usithola.
Sheli repeat ani sekufika ukuthi ngifanele ukukhulisa. Bring attention to this.
Honorable, why you are talking about what Mr. Andy was referring to. He is pointing out to us that note that right now the subcommittee is recommending a deletion of the rule or option.
No, sir. I wanted to raise an issue, one, three, that is a quorum. And then in terms of the proposal that we're putting as a subcommittee, is that the committee at all times require at least one third of its members to be present to conduct any business. There has been a lot of discussion on the committee. And it seems, oral generally speaking, it is acceptable that the committee can start even if there's no one third. But when it has to take a decision, then a quorum must be there. And then I think that is a real discussion that has been long. We're taking a view that everything should start on that. And if it is accepted, Honorable Speaker. The issue of co-option was a long discussion on it, Honorable Speaker. It was almost similar. The expression of the chief whip of the PA. That's sometimes very disadvantaging for members of parliament to come in and just for voting purposes. But we also understood that there would be a lot of parties with so small number. They must be allowed to attend, have some discussion on that, even if they don't form a quorum in a meeting, because the smaller parties don't form a quorum in the meeting. But they participate fully in this discussion. They view what was there, that if we don't accept co-option, very few committees may operate. Because members of committee now, in fact, for smaller parties that have more than five or six committees, and then we can find them anywhere, even if you want to work, because they're very easy meeting of committees. Then we express a view that maybe we should retain the issue of that they can work wherever it's available to work on that. But the committees that we think are very critical committees in terms of the hierarchy of committees in Parliament, like the rules committee where we are going to make some proposals on them. But all other committees for local decisions are allowed to co-opt with us available. The thought that can make it work is not going to cause any damage for the organization.
If you want to do that, I mean, I'm opposed to that, but if you're going to do it, can we not put a clause in the excluding legislation? Because I really, you know, a member of parliament has to, when you take legislative action as legislative, you have to apply your mind to the bill and to the legislation in front of you. And if you come in there just simply and cast your vote, then how can you honestly put your head in the heart and tell people you applied your mind to legislation and its implications for people? So, as I said to you, committee minutes, and it's fine, you know, a report, etc. But I really just think we demean legislative process. If people come into meetings and vote on stuff, they've never engaged, they've never attended the public hearing, they've never participated in any of the deliberations on it. I think it opens us up for a change that we don't actually take legislation seriously as we should.
Madam Speaker, I think it's sensible that the rule should really be deleted, and I think critical thinking process has been applied in the consideration of the removal of this. And for instance, how can the chairperson of a portfolio committee be empowered to decide who should be co-opted from the year, for instance? To sit in a specific committee when the chairperson has no knowledge of the strength or weaknesses of such a member. So let a rule fall. It makes no sense to keep it. And so that can move on. I don't see the point of...
Honorable Zabute.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think it would be better for us to reiterate the rule as is, because we have caucuses. All political parties in this parliament have caucuses, where those members who are serving in that particular portfolio committee will come and brief us about the bill that they are dealing with. So we are not allowing it to fall, honourable members. It must rise. Thanks.
No, it's not.
See, I think you covered by the deputy deputy. But see, the argument that you can't vote because you didn't participate doesn't hold for me, because these things go to the House eventually.
Yeah.
The House has got 400 members, and we vote and we take a decision on the basis of being informed by those who are our representatives in those issues. So whilst I understand what is being said, it really weakens it, but the practicality is that it happens all the time. I think we should hear what Honorable Chair Hazen is saying. It's advisable, but it's not practical, Chair, because it just doesn't happen and it will never happen. So I think it should stay as it is in terms of as it appears currently. Thank you very much.
Honorable Thorley. And
no, thank you, Speaker. No, Speaker, from my own sitting, it is apparent that there are different reasons that arise as to why members who are permanent members of a portfolio or select committee is not available at a specific time when the decision is taken. And those reasons vary from one to the other. However, we must guard against stalling the work of committees, where committees have done an extraordinary amount of work, and then at the last moment we then implement a rule that says that you can't proceed unless this is satisfied. Some members in a committee, Speaker, some of them are either incapacitated for various reasons, or some of them form part of official delegations of Parliament that represent Parliament at national and international forums, and they may not be available. The important thing is that whatever the committee propose is a proposal that will go to the House, as Honourable Smith has said. And we must also guard against a situation where we restrict members of Parliament to participate in activities beyond the area of their specific responsibility in Parliament. Then we're going to reach a stage when debates are taking place and where certain committee members who are not serving on committees participate in debates, where they will be told, "But you have not been part of this process. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about?" And really, in the system of proportional representation where that we implement in Parliament according to the Constitution, political parties must have the right to decide at whichever point who they deploy to make up their quorum.
Honorable Zogu.
Thanks, Chair. You know, when this participated in the subcommittee, there was much more honesty in terms of what occurs. As comrades and members of Parliament say, no, the idea that people come into a committee just to vote is correct, because that's what we do in Parliament. That is not what we do in Parliament. When reports of committees, before we vote them, reports get presented. And then there are responses. In most of the instances, there's even a debate. You don't just get objects, you come in and you just vote on the basis of a party line. In fact, if you set everything in Parliament, even if we agree that we come with mandates, but we always give the benefit of the doubt for people to inform themselves of what is happening. In fact, the other paper gets in distributed way before. You know when you come to the House that such and such a report is in there, ACT, such and such an issue is going to be debated, and you come prepared. It's not true that what occurs at the level of the committee in terms of corruption is the same thing. It's not true. What Honorable Steyn Hazen is talking about is that you have a situation where a person is just fooled. They've never heard what is being discussed. They come in and they vote. That's lousy parliamentarianism. We can't endorse that. In our conscience, we can't endorse that. That's number one.
And then Honorable Florick speaks to the question of forum, of quorum and stalling a work of a committee. If it's one member, actually one member cannot make a quorum not to be considered. Quorum often means 50% plus one of the members present. This rule does not address the quorum. It's being abused at the moment to turn Parliament into a voting kettle. We can't, even if we are the ruling party, actually we reached an understanding. There was so much debate on the thing there at the level of the subcommittee. We want to push members of Parliament in committees to focus, to do work, to be dedicated to the debates that are happening in there, to flesh out issues, to find each other. We are unable to do that at the scale of 400 members. But at the level of the committees, let's have the bed of ideas, let's find each other, let's vote and finish. If a member is not there, it has never happened that the committee work does not move on. A quorum is a quorum. So that's it. Often it's used when the ANC members or DA members are substantially low, then they say, no, let's not move on, there's no quorum, we just co-opt so that the voting balances. No, quorum means members that are there, 50% plus one, they vote, the report moves on. That is what is happening at the moment. This rule is unnecessary, extremely unnecessary. It must fall.
Honorable Smith and then Honorable Sadan.
I'm not sure that I agree with Honorable Ndlozi. Because if I know what Stenhaven and Ndlozi are saying, they're saying you must be an active participant in the committee. Now, we've been saying that there are certain committees where it's just impossible for members to be active participants because there's one member in that committee. In fact, if that is the approach, even the EFF will then be deprived of participating in certain instances because they don't govern all committees. And we're then depriving the political party, because I don't know whether it is legal or acceptable or not, but because I wasn't there on that day, I'm deprived from participating. It can't be correct. It can't be. I'm a member of parliament, and I should participate whenever.
Mm.
So if you're saying to me, it's, I don't know what word was used there, non-parliamentary or something like that, the reverse is true. Because as a member of parliament, I should be able to go anywhere and talk at any point on any matter. And therefore, Chair, I'm saying that this rule is correct as it is here. I'm reiterating that in the House, because that's the ultimate authority, where we all are, you have an opportunity there to accept, reject, or participate further. So I don't understand, and I don't accept what Ndlozi is saying, Chair. I think this rule is there, and probably is saying, because it facilitates the business of Parliament. We can't stop Parliament because Instant wasn't there. It should carry on and facilitate the work of Parliament, Chair. So I think we should move on with the rule as it stands.
Now, I wanted to suggest that perhaps if the rule, if the decision to retain the rule, we could consider saying that co-option would happen only after consultation with the whip of the member concerned. That's something to consider. That is if the rule is retained.
Madam Speaker, my proposal, Honourable Speaker, is that we retain it as it is at the moment. The problem of repairing, sometimes the week won't be available, it will be very difficult sometimes to work it very well. My view is that we can retain it for general discussion, minutes, but take the issue that Honourable Stenhaven is raising. It's an important question that is raising precisely because we are not drafting the rules for us today, but are drafting the rules for the next 20 years. That we should pass this point that is raising for legislation. When we are ready, whatever time, we can come back to the Rules Committee and have a discussion on it. I think on this one, sure, I think we've got members, but on legislation, let us look at it more. We may then take a view once we are ready about some of this question, and we pack it for future consideration.
You must force me.
Well, remember, we've named and blogged this one for some time.
Hmm.
So, indeed, we can't be blamed of not having discussed it. Any other matter on the chapter?
Can you small for a little bit? Not now. Now, see, I've got it.
Madam, there is an issue on Rule 158, that is the Rules Committee. But general on the composition of the Rules Committee is an issue that we wish to make a proposal on. That the Rules Committee, because the Senior Committee of Parliament is a very important committee, we have already agreed earlier on, Honourable Speaker, that the Rules Committee will deal with guidelines and directives. Simply means that the Rules Committee would meet regularly, have meetings to develop guidelines and directives that will affect the functioning of Parliament. When the composition we are proposing, that is the, we should reduce that the size. I think the size is very big. Remember that extremely busy doing work of other committees. We should then have a size that says the 9 members from the ANC, that would include the Speaker and a Deputy Speaker, and 7 other members, and 7 members from opposition, and then can be allocated accordingly. And then, but we think that size of that is 16 will make it very well efficient and effectively, and allow to have a quorum. Then a quorum of 9 is 50 plus 1, I think it's 9. And the committee is able to take decision and move on. When that big amendment then can refer to the chamber. With that, as the chair comes to speak, I very big. It's consuming a lot of time for members who serve in other committees, who are also busy as members of parliament in other committees. And if you reduce it that way, 9, 7 will make up easy, will work. The 8 of it, or 9 of it, is a bottom of that. We thought that we'd be able to cover. Another point that you have raised, that we should then have official, to cover honorable standards, and we should have official alternate members. That would involve to, I think what honorable George was raising, taking any member anywhere. To be members who are official, who are listed there as alternate members. When a member is not there, an alternate member comes. We thought that in the Rules Committee, a very important committee of the Assembly, we should do it that way. It doesn't mean that all committees are not important. But in terms of the work that is done by Rules Committee, it's very important. Therefore, we should have a very flexible, but very efficient committee. But that's what we want to propose. The allocation here then will differ. It's 9, will include the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker and 7 other members. And then also 7 members in terms of the opposition. We think that we should raise that as a principal point. And then how you work out the formula, I think will be easy for the administration to do.
Yeah, I don't
know. Handy?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. There was a separate one page distributed proposing capturing that proposal. And I just want to point out there was a technical error in that paper. Namely, under quorum, there should have been sub 2 saying the majority of the members must be present for it to decide in question for the technical oversight. So please accept my apologies for that.
Okay. Honorable
Ndozi. It's not clear to me which one, Honorable Mdagan, are you proposing? One in the tech or the one in the circulation? Because there are 2 different things. Composition in the circulated paper is not the one that you've just spoken to now. Can we be told which proposal are we dealing with so we can express ourselves?
No, in fact, the point that I'm making, that would be technical error in terms of reading, but it should be 9 and 7. And then 9 on the governing party side would include a speaker and deputy speaker and 7 other members. The opposition would have 7 members. Then the party are proposing on that. Then we have highlighted what are the work and the duties and the responsibility of the committee is there. We thought that really not causing any problem and make it easy for us to work with the team.
The
quorum is
water?
You could have no problem with the formulation, just if I've got the right documents. This one. I can't. What's stipulated here is H7C1. So that is what I can't hear. Maybe I'm adding up incorrectly. And the opposition's fine.
Thank you.
Can I just clarify, yes, the secretary's circulated document indicates speaker, deputy speaker, and then the chief whip of the ANC and five other members. That should read, and six other members. That's the correction there.
Number 8.
Thank you, Speaker. I was just checking. It's really a matter of clarity as to why the Speaker and the Deputy Speaker are made part of the composition of the governing party. Are they not sitting here in their capacity as the leader of the institution as presiding officer? I just wanted clarity on that composition as to why was it structured in that fashion that they will form part of the governing party, as opposed to their role in parliament as speaker and deputy speaker. Unless I heard it wrongly, I just want to clarify that one.
If we read what is there, what we have collected there is just numbers. That the speaker and deputy speaker, in their capacity as elected office bearers, they sit as in the capacity as elected office bearers, plus 7 members of the ANC. Then, I don't want to raise on that. Because the speaker and the deputy speaker anyway, they're from the governing party, so to speak. No, that's
yeah,
your point.
Okay. It's okay.
And then the opposition then will have 7 members. And then that's how we're going to operate on that. And that's not the point where that I elected. When the chief whip was, we thought that generally the chief whip of the parties, they sit in those committees. We can accept that, but the point that we have to be general. They have to see as parties who they put in to the rules committee. As long as 9 and 7, broadly speaking.
Cheers.
We are still chewing on this. Honorable Martin.
I hear the explanation by Honorable Comrade Mika. But the issue is a material one that's raised, that in future the Speaker and Deputy Speaker may not be from the ANC. So in this particular instance, if you are to have the membership of the ANC on a proportional basis, then it should be increased and you exclude the Speaker and Deputy Speaker. So the numbers as they are presently are not correct.
Yeah, right. Correct.
To raise is that you should reduce the vice. Let us work out the democracy no, because we don't attend the meeting anyway. But the point that we have come raising from the speaker is that let us agree that we reduce the size and then the speaker and deputy speaker that are there in the elected official position.
Yes.
We can also take a view that the 10 ANC and 7 other parties. Can we work on that way? Given that the ANC is the 8 member, the opposition is 7 member, that the speaker and the deputy speaker, that is going to be of about 70 or 80, and then that's the one that should work. I'm just saying that in terms of the number, really, the colleagues here are very good in numbers, they can just do it faster in terms of the formula. Then we agree, but we have principle that we reduce the fast. We think the price is very big, it's not going to assist them. When they give guidelines and directives that we have to do. That is the only point shared.
another
presentation. Can we agree on the principle of reduction of the number? Because we are for more than 40 right now, which is rather large. Honorable Josie wants to propose to try a workable site.
You know, the reason why there was a 50 thing in the last week, it was that it's the most powerful committee of parliament. It doesn't sit as often as all other committees. It must be as inclusive of significant forces that run parliament as possible. So, 20 people deciding on the finances, administration, rules, budget, and all those things of parliament is still
that is POA.
I think 50 is fine. It's once in a while.
But I think the majority accepts the principle.
Yeah.
Honorable Zolid is unique. He has a totally different understanding.
Yes, that is unique, right?
Honorable Deputy Chief Whip.
Thanks, Honorable Speaker. We are talking about a rules committee here. The finances and everything else is dealt with by the POA. So the composition should be 10 ANC, 7 opposition, then Speaker and Deputy Speaker. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any objection to that? Honorable Rosen?
No, Deputy Chief, we are already in separate documents, but the functions and powers are stipulated here includes two things. The management, administration and function of the assembly, the financial management and policy of the assembly, including the resources of funding, the budget, income. If I'm reading separate things, I don't know, maybe that's why I asked which document is being proposed.
Honorable Speaker, through you, it's okay even if the functions are those. 19 is okay.
Just to clarify, the text in bold is to be deleted.
I think Kualagi agreed on this matter. Okay. Anything else on this chapter?
Two things. One is that the proposal we had made earlier on, which we said we'll come back to, for us it includes the members of the opposition party being able to chair committee. So the argument we're making earlier on about how to chair in the composition of committees, we think that there must be a way of putting it in the rules to reflect multi-party democracy for 1 in 10, the ratio of 1 in 10 committees entered by a member of the opposition. It doesn't matter where that opposition member comes from to reflect the multi-party system. I don't know whether there's been a consultation at the political level or not. But still, you would remember it was an idea that the convention and government of national unity, I want to state before I'm told of those things that really the proposal is not on the basis of government of national unity. It's about a principle of the constitution, which is multi-party democracy. Even in the leadership of parliament, let's reflect the multi-party democracy without curtailing the leadership of the majority party that it has won, actually. We concede on that. So that's number one. And then I'll come back later. Let's hear that one first. Thanks, Peter.
Honorable Rane.
know, we had a long discussion in the subcommittee on this matter. We have really kindly advised the leadership of the EFF to go to political parties, the governing party leadership, engage with them, have discussion with them. It's not a matter of our rules. We thought that they must do that. Go no, engage the organization, open up. And then the speaker is here, go to the speaker and talk to the speaker. And then the national leadership may meet with you at the political level and have a discussion. It's not a rule issue really that we have on that. It's not because it was the way there. And then, of course, they wrote a very thick document about this, and we appreciate it, reading it. But we can't get a decision on that matter. That's why we referred to them to go to national political leadership and deal with this matter. We don't think they don't have a speaker. They really should consume much of our time on this issue, truly speaking. The subcommittee agrees. Members were there generally agree that this matter is beyond this. They might address it to the leadership of parties.
Okay, so all the structures are listed in this chapter. Can we pass? Yes, Honorable Matthew.
But the Honorable Dadani, that's the sounds more patronizing. The proposal we're making is that let's have rule that enables parties to contribute in the building, in the consolidation of the multi-party system, in the spirit of working towards common national vision, whether we agree with the NDP or not. But that will enable the building of mutual trust and confidence and cooperation amongst parties. Imagine when you can have a situation where Honorable Stian Hazel is one of the chair of the presiding officer. That might stimulate them with different perspectives in how we approach issues in the House. Now,
No, thank you.
We don't want to also in our submission that we need to have this kind of a system. We are not trying to govern by default. Is that the concern of governing by default, right? However, that must also be discouraged, what he said, that leaders of opposition parties must sneak their way to the House to negotiate for corruption, right? That's the system which led into the formation of Bankistan in the past. And dethroning of legitimate traditional leaders in their place, reactionary traditional leaders were appointed. That's the best system. However, we take that the ANC find no concord in what you're proposing. But it's fine, we'll move on.
Yeah, it's better that way.
Do you think what this
is? No, if I read that, you would think.
Okay.
Alright. Thanks, Peter. The other then, as I said in the beginning, there are 2 points to make on the chapter. The other one has to do with the Powers and Privileges Committee.
Your favorite structure.
Chaired by my favorite chapter. We were making a speech. I just need to go to it when I was on the composition. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so I mean, in fact, as things stand, the question of gross violation, ultimately, in our view,
the gross violation of the rules. At the moment, people appear in front of a committee of parliament constituted by members of parliament and or the powers and privileges committee. So I want to get the proper, because everything is bold here, Mr. 89. Okay. Yeah, so we are of the view that under the circumstances of gross violation of the rules, everything else can be dealt with by the Speaker, the DC, and so on and so forth with regards to other injunctions. But under the circumstances of gross violation of rules, particularly as far as the punishment is concerned in relation to gross violation, we must get somebody outside ourselves. Because everybody has a right to appear in front of a neutral judge as a principle of justice. If I appear in front of somebody that we're working with here, one, two, that person cannot be assumed to be neutral. But two, we always indicate that we've got party mandates when we participate in committee. It must be a different committee, like a committee that chooses judges in parliament. It's not a parliament committee. It's considered by other people as well. Then it is thought to be much more vibrant. But we naturally vote on the basis of party line. You can't vote on the basis of party line that somebody is guilty. Like, it's actually a serious violation of the principles of natural justice. You must appear in front of a neutral judge, and even if it's a jury that votes on your guilt or what, verdict, it must be independent of the prosecutorial team as well as the defense team, who must appear in front of a neutral. So our view is that there must be a completely new process. And Honorable Mdakani, we gave you a proposal and the subcommittee. It was not handed here, we don't know why.
Then yes, we don't want it.
Do you have anything to say, Honorable Mdakani? No. Okay.
Honorable Speaker, we agree that you are going to submit this proposal. Documentation can be made available to any member want to read it to this, but it was for the rule purposes to do so. We appreciate the document.
So that's
184. Yeah. I also just wanted to highlight, I'm just looking for the rule now, the facts are being introduced in these rules, a disciplinary committee. So I just want to bring that to the attention of the 184.
If this is rule 194B, part 7, then this is not committed.
Your attention has been drawn to
194.
Proposed rule 194B.
Okay. B. 194.
Okay. Any comments? This is the point I believe Honorable Buzi would want his proposal also factored into consideration of the structure. No, I'm saying here the proposal on 194B. He is saying there is a proposal that they submitted, which Mr. Mdakani confirmed, which of course is not before us right now. But this is not necessarily a matter we have to commit
in terms of how Mr. Ngarane introduced it. That, you know, here the proposal, consider it. If we have something to say, go ahead and say. Otherwise, I'd like to move us. Honorable Kubai, Honorable Ndlovu.
Thanks, Speaker. I think this is a, while I understand that we might not commit today, but it's something that is important, a DC committee. For example, and I'll make with honorable, especially because he's going to speak after me, and he showed the middle finger in the house as he was there. I told you. As he was walking out, he sat right across, which was clearly visible. Now, in such a case, Speaker, it can be left to the presiding officer. It's not a matter of somebody just breaking the rule. It's a manner of conduct. Like, more, for example, if you look at it and this, you, I feel that it's insulted, it was us. Now, you are insulted in the house. Now, I just can't remember previously. There's been cases like that previously. Maybe the National Assembly Secretary will assist us. There were cases where you found members have done something cross, and a protest was put in place, and a sanction was decided upon. So I think putting it into the rule gives some level of us understanding. When this is done, this is how it will be dealt with. That's how I view it. While knowing what Honorable Ntakane said, that we shouldn't, we might fight it for now, but I think it's something that we should not leave it because it's very important.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Look, unfortunately, the Constitution is very clear. You cannot be prosecuted for the things that you say in the house. Like the absolute freedom of speech, that sense. But the house must put rules and procedures in place to conduct its business. I must say from the beginning, this is not a proposal to say we shouldn't go for misconduct. I agree that there is misconduct. And often when people engage us, they think that we are saying that there shouldn't be some form of constituting an order in the house. Yes, there must be an order, but there must not be a suppression of the freedom of speech at the same time. Now, there are two things why you must have an independent person looking to it outside of us. It's done, but, and I'm saying, Speaker, under circumstances of gross violation, which we have defined. In those instances, you must save all of us. The speaker, the presiding officers, and all those people. Just on the basis of principles of natural justice, it makes sense. But I'm going to show you as well that why you must do that in relation to what we say are some of the things that can happen at the end. It's a suspension. If you're going to suspend a member of parliament on the basis of the gross violation of rules, you don't want to go in there and vote on the basis of party lines. That is what, that's the business of parliament here. The structure can be abused. You will have ground in any court of law to always dismiss whatever parliament or that disciplinary committee decides. You can go in court and say only on the basis of natural justice that committee was wrong. Even you can even arrive on an urgent basis. And the principles of natural justice, all those people belong to political parties, it falls under the section of the composition. If you read this entire section of the rules, we work on party lines, proportional representation, in what, even this committee that is being proposed here, it will belong to political parties. So, if we must have a DC, the question is, how should that DC constitutionally stand and reach decisions? We get a proposal. We must appoint a retired judge, or senior counsel who is independent, comes and listens to the issue. Right, a person makes their representation, they get represented by a lawyer, what the case might be, even these institutions like universities, that's how they conduct the disciplinary process. And they recommend a sanction. which can come back to us, and then we vote on that sanction. But the process of litigation and all those things must happen in front of a natural judge, of a neutral judge. That's the principle of natural justice. Then it can come to a committee, it can come to the Powers and Privileges Committee. They say, okay, in terms of an independent process, we have been found guilty. They are recommending 5 or 10 days suspension. What are spending you were decided. Sanctions can be decided like that, but the process must be in front of a neutral individual, properly trained to listen to a case, and so on. That is all I say. And the perfect example is the case of the ESF, which was removed, then referred to the Powers and Privileges Committee. If you want to attain that, appoint a retired judge or appoint a senior counsel that we all agree, and then it will be fine. Otherwise, it will never stand in court, and Parliament will just be wasting its time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Speaker. If I understand the proposal well in terms of the proposal, it doesn't take away the function of the Power and Privileges Committee, which will deal with issues of gross
issues of contempt.
Issues of contempt and any other. But in respect of the disciplinary committee, I thought it's a mechanism that is proposed in order to deal with almost daily issues of misconduct in the House, where a committee can quickly deal with those issues and recommend an assumption that must be taken. But it also allows the member concerned to be able to plead in mitigation and argue his or her case. And in fairness, I don't think for that type of a process, you would really need to bring somebody from outside. That would be my take.
No, I'm not married either way, or who chairs it, but I think Honourable does make a point about impartiality, because and we do operate in a political environment, and often, and I think we've seen it in other committees, there's a political imperative rather than the rules of natural justice, but it's for the committee to decide. I do want to argue strongly in favour of a disciplinary committee, and I hope that we can move somewhere towards establishing one and setting up its procedures. I just think we've had too many instances in the House where the same incidents keep happening over and over again. You know, particularly quite upset the use of swear words in the House and obscene gestures. Now, I can get up in the House tomorrow and call the Honourable Indokani whatever I like and sit down and say I would call. And I can do that every day for the rest of the year if I want to. I can call in the most terrible manner if I want to. And at the moment there's no ability for us to deal with that type of behaviour. And the incidents last this week in the House really brought me back to what happened when one of my own members, prior to my arrival here in Parliament, was leaving the chamber after a particular heated walkout. And now the words, not even on the microphone, now the words that were inappropriate to be said in Parliament. She got a 7,000 rand fine and was suspended from Parliament for 5 days. Now, on an almost daily basis, people have been told in the House to F off, have been called the most terrible names. And I just don't think that the current system is a mechanism for us to deal with it. So it's not a Powers and Privileges violation, and it's not an Ethics Committee violation either. It deals with behaviour in the House. And so, I don't know whether we're going to, in looking back at the annotated digest of rulings, it looked like it was at one stage in the first and second Parliament, the Disciplinary Committee, there was a ad hoc in the third that was established. And I think that was carried over into the summer of the fourth. But, you know, I think it's the mechanism that we need where we're able as peers to, you know, to say, well, look, this sort of behaviour is not acceptable in the House. And we need to make a sense to deal with whether that's chaired by a retired judge or whether it's an independent third person. Some good comments there. But either way, I think this committee needs to be established in order to ensure the integrity of the House is protected.
No, Madam Speaker, we really accepted this. The point today was that we accept the establishment of the GC and work out the modalities over time. I think we are accepted that and we are very happy that we must.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also just want to add that I fully support the establishment of the disciplinary committee, and we should not conflict the powers and privileges of the disciplinary committee. But I think that maybe the bone of contention could be in the establishment in terms of it's fine for a deputy speaker to be the chairperson and a senior whip from each party, which makes it fair, but there could be a problem with the production of bias in C, 194BC, and any other assembly member or members designated by the speaker. One could perhaps look at that wording in consultation with the whips, senior whips, to exclude that presumption of bias. I think this meeting establishes the agreement on the principles of establishment of a disciplinary committee and the need, as experience has shown us. It's mandate coming out very clearly. I think those are some of the things that we will function as we go. Honorable Nobi?
Now, let me ask a question. What if it's the speaker that is in gross violation of the rules, or is the speaker that... Not you, Honorable Balambe, I'm hypothesizing. Because when you make rules, you must think in a much more permanent process. Now, the problem is, with DC, that I want to present, the last problem that I had is, there's often no recourse in relation to the speaker, in a sense. So, one of the qualities that one needs is one that can be able to take powerful people to talk about their gross violation of the rules. Like when they dismiss the person unfairly. What happens in that instance? So I go to a DC, it says, firstly, the DC, a presumption of bias here stands, I think, and I think we can prove that in a court of law. If it's an independent person in my instance, who both presented that I was not wrong, the decision was made by who that was wrong? By the speaker. I come and I appear in front of the same person. That says I was wrong in the house by June 1234. It's not viable, this DC, the way it's composed. So we must be able to get an independent person, and the speaker defends herself or himself that I was wrong by June 1234, and then I present myself, then the session is taken out. Thank you.
Honorable Mazzoni, Honorable Boy, Honorable Deputy Chief Whip. Thank you, Speaker. Firstly, I think that there is a right of recourse against the rule of a speaker, and our recourse is through this Rules Committee. And we must investigate that, and we must not bias. This Rules Committee is where we hold the speaker to account, and there are procedures to be followed if we want to appeal a decision of the speaker and it's done through the Rules Committee. Chair, the one thing, though, I do think procedurally could get us into a little bit of trouble in the disciplinary committee is that there is no provision for an appeal against the decision made in the disciplinary committee. So when we busy doing a redraft, we must allow for an appeal, because that's just within the flow of natural justice. Honorable Boy, Honorable Deputy Chief Whip.
Can I give the Deputy Chief Whip?
Honorable Speaker, I think I agree with the colleagues who said that we need this committee. And in terms of the Constitution, Chapter 7, Chapter 57 of the Constitution allows the National Assembly to have its own internal procedures. So it will stand even in court of law, because it's given here in the Constitution. So we need that. And we also believe in all senior whips of political parties. So in the committee there will be no biasness, because only senior whips of the parties will sit in this committee. Thanks.
You.
Okay, Honourable Members, the principle is established. We will then make sure that we take care of all issues that have been raised in the finalization of the formulation. Can we go to Chapter 13?
In terms of preparing a set of rules for the House to adopt, do we leave this in or take it out?
Mm.
without a detailed conversation. That's the case. The legislative process.
I know what I'm doing. Agreed.
Okay. Can't hear?
I think let's decide on the issue. That's what we were trying to get a study group to discuss.
Mm.
And don't you say morning is difficult for you?
The problem is that the excuse is not there. On Tuesday.
Mm.
And it deprives me of the opportunity
to well, on
in the government. It's not like I don't want to
do that. On this chapter, Honorable Baker, there's an issue of access to it. The point that we want to raise that there will be, because we put it as a master's written letter, so there should always be first reading. But we always know that there will be technical things that we may not need first reading. I think we should cover it. We try to phrase it in a way that allows the programming committee to take a decision on it. It shouldn't just must, every bill must be first written. I think it would be very difficult. Because of the situation where we think all of us, this is a technical piece, hasn't made any first reading. I think we should have an idea. It's the only issue that we wanted to raise in this area.
It goes subsequent to as well 248A where it says sub first reading as well. I think the same must apply.
Let's move to chapter 14.
Miscellaneous, nothing. Miscellaneous is miscellaneous.
Hello.
Miscellaneous
is under Appendix C. Agree. Now, on that note of the smell of food, I think we should again come back at 2 and go through the things on which we have not finalized, so that we can then be very clear that we'll finalize everything and we are taking an agreed report to the House for adoption next week. So the root committee is adjourned until after lunch at 2. Yes, that's true for city. Have I not seen it?
Yeah.
Or you want to come back at 1:30?
Oh.
Okay, 1:30.